KALW.
At the Golden Gate, a single plover far at sea wings across the horizon. A single rower, almost out of sight, rows his skull into eternity.
Yesterday would have been Lawrence Ferlinghetti's 105th birthday.
Art is built on art, and you ripped off quite a number of poems.
You said it. So did Picasso. So did T.S. Eliot, who even said, "I summarize the past by theft and illusion."
He was a painter, a poet, a social activist, and co-founder of the iconic City Lights bookstore.
Some of the first publications we sold were two Italian anarchist newspapers in Italian.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Yesterday would have been Lawrence Ferlinghetti's 105th birthday. Ferlinghetti is considered the spiritual godfather of the beat movement. And in 2019, on his 100th birthday, the city honored him by declaring March 24th a day to celebrate his legacy. Now, we're bringing you a documentary about the former San Francisco poet laureate that was produced by Jim McKee of Earwax Productions in partnership with the Kitchen Sisters. In it, we'll hear Jim's voice alongside Ferlinghetti's and radio dramatist Eric Bowersfield. The story begins with Ferlinghetti reciting his poem, Moored.
A boat moored in the deep shade, under a weeping willow, in the bend of a river. As the light fades, so does the boat, with its willow, with its river. Only memory remains of the lovers in the bottom of the boat, moored to each other. They, too, gone on.
My name is Jim McKee. I met Lawrence Ferlinghetti through my mentor, Eric Bowersfield. Eric was in charge of drama and literature at KPFA. When I first met Lawrence, we were meeting down at the farmer's market here when it was at the bottom of Broadway near the Embarcadero to have coffee and pastries. We would hang out there for an hour and a half, 2 hours. My studio was close enough that we'd just walk over to the studio and all do work together.
I was going to ask you a question about your poetry.
Go right ahead.
Every time I read your poems, I find something else I had not noticed before, even though it was there all the while. And one big image that...
What makes you think it was there all the while?
Well, I never noticed it before, but it always seems to be there. You start with particulars in many of your poems and end up with something vast, like eternity or a great panorama. And it seems in almost everything from the little dog who's walking along the street who then becomes the dog beside a great horn that blasts out to the entire universe.
Oh, it's the Victor Record dog
listening to
the horn.
But the last line of it is, and then there's at the Golden Gate, single plover, just a single plover. And then at the end, rose his skull into eternity through the Golden Gate Bridge.
The skull is a play on S-C-U-L-L.
A
rowing skull, but obviously a play on SK. At the Golden Gate. At the Golden Gate, a single plover far at sea wings across the horizon. A single rower, almost out of sight, rows his skull into eternity, and I take a Buddha crystal in my hand and begin becoming pure light. You know, rowing his skull into eternity, S-K-U-L-L, it reminds me of the Hieronymus Bosch in the Garden of Delights, where you have images like that, a man rowing a human skull.
If you were telling
somebody in their 20s who wasn't from San Francisco, didn't know city lights. What would you say to them to bring them into Lawrence's world?
In the early 50s, Lawrence came from the East Coast. He took a train over and took a ferry into the city because there was no Bay Bridge. Not long after arriving, he decided that he was going to start a bookstore that sold paperback books. Paperback books were a new thing. He partnered up with someone here in North Beach, began City Lights Bookstore back in 1954.
What put City Lights and Lawrence on the map?
City Lights is known for publishing writers who have far-out ideas, politically progressive ideas. He began the Pocket Poet series, a publication that fit his MO, so to speak, at City Lights because it was small, 4 by 6 inch.
Fit in your pocket.
That fit in your pocket. The first publication was Pictures of the Gone World, poems that he wrote. Then he commissioned other writers and poets. Allen Ginsberg's Howl was the fourth publication that he did. After publishing Howl, Allen Ginsberg was called in on obscenity charges. They pulled the publication from the public. Lawrence had to go to court. They won the case. It was a landmark case in terms of First Amendment rights to be able to write and publish works like Howl.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix, angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night, who poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness of cold water flats floating across the tops of cities contemplating jazz.
We had this anarchist background, anarchist slant right from the beginning.
Did you start City Lights in the same location it is now, or did you start it elsewhere?
The bookstore was always in the same location, 261 Columbus Avenue. I had a partner originally, Peter Dean Martin, the son of Carlo Tresca, who was an Italian anarchist assassinated on the streets of New York, perhaps by the mafia, I think in the early 1940s. And we had actually, some of the first publications we sold were two Italian anarchist newspapers in Italian. And at that time, North Beach was populated by like 90% Italians. And among the people who would buy the Italian anarchist newspaper were the scavengers on the garbage truck. I remember one guy wearing a derby and baggy pants would rush in off the garbage truck and get his copy of Umanita Nova or La Dunata was the other one. And we had that newspaper for years, those two newspapers for years, until I think both of them went out of existence, maybe in the 60s.
That theme is so prevalent here in San Francisco. I mean, almost everywhere you live, wherever you go, you have this view of this bay that leads out under the Golden Gate Bridge.
I know.
Out into the ocean.
San Francisco, it's an old Indian myth going all the way back several centuries of San Francisco as an island. So we're surrounded by water on three sides, and with the melting of the icebergs, the water will rise just a few feet or even a foot or two, and it'll flood over the remaining fourth side, the very low-lying landmass between San Francisco and what's known as the San Francisco Peninsula. And then San Francisco will be an island again. And there was always an island mentality. And when I arrived in San Francisco by ferry from Oakland, having come on the train across the continent, I had the feeling that the citizens really had this island mentality, and they were sort of like Neapolitans who considered themselves Neapolitans first and Italians second. So in 1950 I felt San Franciscans felt they were San Franciscans first and then only secondarily members of the United States. And so we're sort of an off-lying island, not really part of the continent.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Today we're featuring Rivers of Memory, produced by Jim McKee of Earwax Productions in partnership with the Kitchen Sisters. It's conversations, poetry, and art with Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Now back to the story.
Lawrence and Eric both served in the Navy in World War II. I think when you get to be in your late 80s and most of your friends are gone, it's nice to have somebody not only that served in the service with you in the Navy, but just to have somebody your own age that you can reminisce things about.
Yeah, I almost shipped out from San Francisco a couple of times before I got a job.
Well, when were you on immersion ship?
Oh, well, I was in the first year of the war, the winter of 41-42. I was on the old Liberty ships on convoys to Europe. One New York to Belfast, 28 days. We zigzagged all over the ocean, so our forward motion was maybe not more than 8 or 10 knots, because we were zigzagging. And so it took forever to get there, and there's ice on the rigging, and I was on the armed guard crew manning the anti-aircraft gun on the bow of the Liberty ship. We made several convoys across the Atlantic. The first one I was on, about half the convoy was torpedoed. Only about half the ships made it across.
Yeah, I know. That was when I was getting a ship. When the Navy assigned us to merchant ships, they gave us fouled weather gear, and I had a mountain of it waiting for me when I got to the dock waiting to get the merchant ship.
Yeah.
But it turned out the ship went back and forth to Brazil, so I never needed it, but it was on the ship, and I had all this fouled weather gear with me. But those were dangerous days for merchant ships there.
Yeah, they were.
And they broke in half, too, every once in a while, didn't they? They didn't need an enemy to help.
Those Liberty ships were very thin skin, very thin hull, like an eighth of an inch steel. That's why they call them tin cans. Well, the tin cans are what they call the destroyers, actually.
Yeah. Is the O'Brien, the Jeremiah O'Brien, that kind of a ship?
Yeah, exactly.
We should go over and see it someday.
Yachts in sun. The yachts, the white yachts, with their white sails in sunlight, catching the wind and heeling over, all together racing now for the white buoy, to tack about, to come about beyond it, and then come running in before the spanking wind, white spinnakers billowing off Fort Mason, San Francisco, where once drowned down an Alcatraz con escaping, whose bones today are sand 50 fathoms down, still imprisoned now in the glass of the sea, as the so skillful yachts freely pass over. The so skillful yachts freely pass over is a ripoff from a famous poem by William Carlos Williams. His line, I believe, is, "And the yachts skillfully pass over." So that was really a total ripoff on my part.
Well, art is built on art, and you've ripped off quite a number of poems.
You said it.
Well, I was looking at
so
one.
Did Picasso.
Well, so did, I presume, Shakespeare and every major poet.
So did T.S. Eliot, who even said, I summarized the, he said, I forget, he was talking about the Four Quartets or The Wasteland. He said, summarizing the past by theft and illusion. Not illusion, but A-L-L.
How did you become, or how do you feel about being the keeper, being Eric's keeper, being Lawrence's keeper? You are their keepers.
I have most everything Lawrence recorded. That's all been cataloged. And with Eric's archive, I was looking at, you know, 50 years of work product, radio interview material, in wanting to help him get a website created. As we digitize these tapes, you begin to realize that it was not even the tip of the iceberg.
Why do you think it's important? What drew you?
One of the things that I began to realize when I started hanging out with these guys is that they were from a different place and time. And they were talking about things that I couldn't really even put into context. I had no idea why you'd be so upset about having some logo on your hat or your t-shirt or your clothing, or what it was about advertising that bugged them so much. Over the years, you realize the world that they came up in and the way that they were in some ways snookered into the war was through advertising. To be able to contextualize that life, it literally took a decade of hanging out with them to understand what the world was like when they were growing up, what the world was like when they went into war. It was just a real eye-opener for me to finally get a glimpse into their world.
The sea is calm tonight, off Dover Beach. The birds at dusk cry out syllables of some deconstructed word we are yet unable to decipher to explain existence. And they lift the last light with their wings and fly away with it over the horizon, keeping the secret. The sea was calm that night off of Normandy and off of Dover Beach. But things were not so calm in the United States, where the whole transfer of wartime techniques of propaganda had begun, patriotic posters and so forth, so that these same techniques could be used in peacetime and by big business. The government manufactured the consent of the American public to go into the Second World War. And, of course, this is what Noam Chomsky articulated many years later in his book, Manufacturing Consent. And the government was able to do the same for our entry into the Iraq War. Manufactured consent by control of the media. Look at that. Isn't that a beautiful picture? Yeah, that's in our little wardroom where Gene and... The Green Street Mortuary Marching Band, well, whenever the Green Street Mortuary Marching Band came out of Green Street and headed down Columbus Avenue in a funeral parade, I always thought, well, I've got to write a poem about that, so I finally did.
Who do they play for? Do they play for any?
They play for the dead.
I know, do you have to be the elected dead? Or?
You have to be dead to get the Green Street Mortuary Marching Band.
And right. Rich, or are they...
Are they rich?
You have to be rich to hire them.
Oh, no, I don't think it's outrageous. But quite often it seems it's some perhaps rich Chinese patriarch. The biggest funerals are often these days great Chinese patriarchs with long lines of limousines following afterward. Now, where is that poem in here?
It really happened. The Green Street Mortuary Marching Band marches right down Green Street and turns into Columbus Avenue, where all the cafe sitters at the sidewalk cafe tables sit talking and laughing and looking right through it as if it happened every day in little old wooden North Beach, San Francisco, but at the same time feeling thrilled by the stirring sound of the gallant marching band.
Which poem for you, when you think of Lawrence, what poem is it?
After about 10 years meeting him on Saturdays and meeting him with Eric at brunch, I invited him to come down when he felt like it to read his poetry here. The last 10 years, we've recorded most all of what he calls his selected collection. When he's reading these poems, often just to get him in the mood or loosen the tension in the room, I'll try to have him set it up, you know, so where did this idea come from? And he told me a story about visiting Russia, getting on a train across Siberia to the very end, and he actually got pneumonia while he was in this little town on the eastern wilderness of Russia. He wrote a short poem called A Recipe for Happiness.
This is Lawrence Ferlinghetti, December 21st, 2012. Recipe for happiness in Khabarovsk or any place. One grand boulevard with trees, with one grand cafe in sun, with strong black coffee in very small cups, one not necessarily very beautiful man or woman who loves you, one fine day.
That documentary, Rivers of Memory, first aired in 2018. It was produced by Jim McKee of Earwax Studios and the Kitchen Sisters, with Nathan Dalton and Brandy Howell. Original music was produced by Vyacheslav Pogacheski. Lawrence Ferlinghetti died in 2021 at the age of 101. You can find a link to learn more about him and his legacy at KALW.org. Tune in tomorrow morning at 11. We'll hear what it feels like to return home after spending time in prison.
You know, there are the kind of mundane challenges that a returned citizen faces. Those challenges I was prepared for because I had set a plan, a course of action for my success.
A special episode of Uncuffed featuring stories of re-entry. That's tomorrow morning at 11. Before we leave you, here's some music from a Bay Area band.
Through a canyon in New Mexico, in the subtle warmth of spring, I heard like hummingbirds or bayonets, a sweet and somber singing.
This is Berkeley's Forget Me Nots. They'll be playing this Friday at Richmond's Baltic Kiss.
I know that song, percussive as firewood, snapping in the night, or a misspent childhood, copying lines in a schoolhouse when I should.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Sarah Jesse, Lina Najia Basuni, James Rollins, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tenz, Shireen Adil, Angela Johnston, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.